Hello, welcome to the Higher Education Researcher. This is a podcast by the Center for Higher Education Research and Evaluation at Lancaster University. My name is Olga Rotter, and my guest today is Murat Öztok. Murat is a lecturer at the doctoral programs Social Justice and Technology Enhanced Learning at Lancaster University. Welcome and thank you for coming, Murat.
Hi, thank you.
Today we talk about Murat's new book, The Hidden Curriculum of Online Learning, Understanding Social Justice Through Cultural Pedagogy. In his book, Murat argues that online learning environments can produce inequitable learning conditions and elaborates on how the hidden curriculum of online education can maintain cultural hegemony. Murat, could you please summarize for our audience what is your book about?
Yeah, thank you. The title is pretty explanatory. The book is trying to understand online education from social justice point of view. And it starts from two arguments, and those arguments are actually based in the literature of online education. So one of those arguments is that the argument is that online education is providing equal opportunities to people because it's anytime, anywhere access. So because of this anytime, anywhere access, people can go online anytime and anywhere, and then it just brings everybody in together in one place. So thus, it provides more opportunities for people to really participate in. So this is one of the arguments. And the other argument in the literature, online education literature, is that because online education is a place where everybody can participate in to the discussion, and therefore it should be much more democratic compared to face-to-face classrooms, I guess. So I took those two arguments and I just wanted to provide a counter argument with the evidence that, in fact, in online education, yes, it is true that there's anytime, anywhere access. And yes, it is true that people can participate, but that's only at the surface level is providing some sort of opportunity. But that opportunity doesn't necessarily reflect it in the actual practices. So the book wanted to show how daily interactions in online education between students and teachers, and how people react to each other and how they communicate with each other, those things, those daily interactions create another level of unjust situations for people. So the book is trying to go beyond those two mainstream discourses in online education. And to be honest, those arguments that anytime, anywhere access is providing more opportunities for people, and the other argument that because people can participate, online education is providing more opportunities, those are more like self-fulfilling prophecy type of things. There isn't enough research in actually to prove that these things are really happening. So the book has two outcomes, one in online education literature showing that those claims are empty, doesn't necessarily happening. And the other argument is happening on the social justice side, where we might need to actually look differently into what's happening in online education.
Murat, you begin your discussion with a statement that equity is a value-laden concept that is not easy to define. What is your perspective on equity?
Well, in the book, I try to separate equity from equality. And to me, that's an important separation. That's a very important part to really understand social justice, in my opinion. So I define equity as a fair distribution of resources, or the fairness. Let's say equity to me is fairness. So this fairness cannot necessarily be defined in numbers. So it's not necessarily quantified, but there should be some qualitative judgments. What is fair? So equity would necessarily have qualitative judgment in it, and therefore it means that we really have to be quite aware of the situation that we're trying to understand. So that would require us to really understand the people that we're dealing with, the situation we're in. And if we're talking about necessarily education in here, we really have to understand the curriculum that we would like to deliver and the students in this course that we're doing. And then also the setting, the school. So it just has different levels, like the micro level and the meso level and the micro level. So it has to be all qualitative understanding of who we are and what we do and who are students and what is it that they want to do. So the equity would necessarily try to make things fair for everybody else. So, for example, if you are a student who is in need of time because of language barriers, then you know, you cannot necessarily argue that, no, this is the end, very strict end deadline, unless it's like the reason that it has to be a strict deadline. Sometimes it has to be, but those flexibilities offering to students in need of help, particularly in online education, would be a fair assessment or fair judgment. Or another example would be is that where if there's a student who is in need of a little bit more help, a little bit more explanation than the others for any accessibility reasons, then providing all these extra support and extra material to those students would be a point of equity. Equality, on the other hand, would be here is everything that I'm giving it to you, and it's your responsibility as a student to make it out, to make the best out of this. So equality would necessarily mean fair and being equal to everyone in the same term, but equity would be being fair to everybody in terms of what is it that their needs and how is it that you could support them. So that's the main difference between equity and equality. And equity, to me, is a key concept to really understand social justice.
Thank you, Murat. In your work, you state that online education as such and access to education do not ensure equity and social justice. What problems do you see in the relation between existing learning practices, equity, and social justice?
I think one of the things that we have to understand is that how these practices are happening, how these discourses are happening in online education. So to give an example of those relationships is to look into the idea of whiteness. In fact, that's pretty much what I'm talking about in the book, in trying to understand the discourses of whiteness and trying to understand how those discourses really create in different positions, different identifications for different people, and thus in return creating differentiated learning opportunities for people. So one of the things to understand those discourses, equity and social justice, is in fact to look at how people are positioned into each other, how people are in fact creating stereotypes among each other. So for example, because, you know, my name is Murat, and if you know a little bit about my name, so you know, you would guess that I'm from Turkey best or somewhere close to Middle East. And then all of a sudden, just through by looking at my name, people might have an idea who I am, only because that we operate on those stereotypes. But then, is that really true? So I could have been a person born in, let's say, the United Kingdom, but still the name Murat, and I would have nothing to do with Turkey. But people do not know this, only because just by looking at my name, there's going to be a lot of assumptions happening to me. And that's just one example. There could be a lot of assumptions just by looking at people's skin color, and people's level of English proficiency, and other things. And in fact, the language bias is a very much existing phenomenon. So people think that only because somebody's level of English, speaking level of English, perhaps is not as accurate as the others, all of a sudden you might think that this person doesn't know what he or she's talking about. Or the other things about the gender discourses, you know, you might have some male roles assigned to you or female role assigned to you, and you just have to go with that or comply with that or go against with that. You know, so there's a lot of discourses coming into play. And when we go online, all these discourses are coming with us. So just to give an example, here we are in the United Kingdom, right? So we assume that only because the university is offering these courses, our students must be British. But that's not true. We have an international audience. Our students are spread all over the world. And we cannot really start from the British point of view or the British perspective to really deliver these courses. Or we have a lot of British students living abroad. So that's also something to be really careful about. And we also have a lot of international students living in here. So just by looking from the international point of view, we have very different audience. We have very diverse group of students. And because everybody's mindset is different, when you bring them into a one online course, it's just finding who is right or finding the balance between how people should understand each other becomes very much of a problem. So this is where equity and social justice comes in. Whose voice are we going to be listening? Whose perspectives are we going to be taking? Whose ideas of what is good and acceptable are we going to be operate on? So as a lecturer, do I set these things or do I really let these nuances emerge through people's discussions? If those understandings emerge through people's discussions, then does it necessarily mean that is it really opening and welcoming everyone? For example, can anybody 100% sure tell me that everybody thinks that they're being heard and they're being accepted and respected properly? So probably the answer is no. So these things happen. And the book is trying to show that sometimes, unfortunately, these things happen in ways that we don't realize, and then in happening ways that's necessarily marginalizing certain group of people over and over again. And this is where I look at the problem, and this is what I define as the problem of equity or the problem of social justice. So the relationship is that those discourses are embedded within us. The way that we operate as human beings are just through discourses. The way that we put courses together are just operated by discourses. And when all these discourses come into together, how they enact and how people engage with each other through those discourses are just creating social injustices. And the challenging part is that it's not one formula that we could follow to avoid this, because every course is different, every student cohort is different, the teachers would be different, and the course material would be different. So all these dynamics would make very hard to spot where the injustices are happening. I guess that's the challenging part, but also the fascinating part as a researcher, that there's almost an endless opportunity to really go and explore.
Thank you, Murat. You argue that inequity is reproduced through discourses and that educational institutions maintain such cultural reproduction through the hidden curriculum. Could you give us concrete examples of how discourses reproduce unequal learning conditions in an online environment?
Yes. So an example could be from the book itself. In the book, I'm trying to show this through discourses of whiteness. So the book is looking at one institution in Canada, and in Canadian Constitution, which is called the Bill of Rights, multiculturalism is an asset that's set to be protected as a Canadian value. But if you were to go deep a little bit into understanding of what is multiculturalism, it comes down to the fact that multiculturalism represents actually anybody who is francophone or anglophone background from either France or from Scotland or England. So if you are coming from that kind of a background, and if you are coming from a white background, then all of a sudden you become the real Canadian. And obviously this is not happening in any kind of an official format, but this is the unspoken understanding among people. And when you go into the online learning community, or when you go into online learning classrooms or courses, for example, this idea is finding its way into the discussions in terms of who can speak with what kind of an authority. So in those discussions, what I discovered and what my participants told me in the interviews was that oftentimes, although these students are Canadian, they're either Canadian born or they're either got citizenship neutralization through later on living over there, but they're as Canadian as anybody can be. But although they're Canadian, they could have never been accepted as Canadians in those discussions. They always have to be hyphened Canadian. So, for example, they could be, let's say, Turkish Canadian or a Russian Canadian, or my examples in the book were that they were Caribbean Canadians or Indian Canadians. So they could have never been the real Canadian that they were. So because that they were hyphened and because they were associated with their other part more so than their Canadian part, they always have to be playing an identity that is not necessarily who they are. And because they were enacting to be somebody else, then what they were learning out of that course was not necessarily what is it that they thought they could really get out. So they were always positioned as somebody else, as others. But they could have never been, I guess, a real Canadian. So if you look at this from a bigger point of view, you might just simply think, oh, that's not a problem. They have a different heritage, so why should that be a problem? But the problem comes into the fact that they have always been pushed into these positions, and these positions were always regarded as something that they diversify the classroom. They diversify the perspective. So they were never the mainstream, but they were always the others who were really helping the actual real Canadians who could really learn. So they were just over there to diversify the curriculum. So when people talk about, well, this is a very diverse classroom, this is all over the world, they never mean that this is diverse because there are white, anglophone or francophone Canadians in here, but they always say it's diverse because there's Indians and Caribbeans and Middle Easterns over here. So they never thought themselves to be equally diverse as everybody else. So the whites were always the core, the norm. So everybody else was positioned as the other. So this was, for example, creating inequity because, like I said, if you are positioned as who you are not, then what is it that you could learn at the end of the course is going to be less than what is it that you could really learn actually. And on those interactions with your peers is always based on how you were to be understood by them. My participants were telling me that they were pretending to be somebody else only because that they could be legitimized or they could continue with interacting with others, because whenever they tried to enact who they are, then all of a sudden interactions were becoming very course related and nothing was really happening in terms of all these social learning aspects of it, or the implicit or the tacit learning aspects.
Thank you very much, Murat. Could you please also describe the type of online learning environment that can support equity and social justice, and also mention the challenges in its implementation?
Well, that's actually quite a good question, and it would be a little bit hard to answer. Let me start the answer from the second part of the question, and I guess that would explain why it would be hard. The challenge is that, and I think I also said this briefly in one of my answers to the previous question, the challenge is that every setting would be different. Every online space would be different because the participants would be different, the teacher would be different, and the course material would be different. And through these differences, it would be very hard to define where the inequity lies. But obviously, there are some indicators that we could look into. So some people call them the usual suspects, or some people call them the holotheorists, depending on your perspective. I go with the usual suspects. Usually race, gender, and class, social class, would be the things that you could really try to look into, understand these injustices. But with the things are changing, I guess race doesn't necessarily cover everything at the moment in quite a good way. So ethnicity is becoming a much more powerful term to define these nuances. And lately, for example, also quite find its voice in the UK is the idea of whiteness is also coming more to the fore in scholarly analysis. Also, I guess heteropatriarchy is slowly finding its way. Heteropatriarchy is particularly looking into the queer studies and trying to deconstruct the gender roles or the gender assumptions that we have. So there are certain discourses that we could really follow them, and then we could really try to understand how injustices might be happening in any given courses. But obviously, these are only the things that we know. And I'm sure as the research continues on this, there's going to be more and more new ways of analysis and ways of methodologies will be coming up for us to really understand how this is happening. So that was the challenging part, because there's no pre-formula, there's no really any given blueprints to really follow through to really ensure to have a class that supports equity. And the other thing to understand why this is a challenge is that equity is not necessarily an end term. It's usually a goal towards that we could go through. So we might have, for example, gender balance in somehow, but that might unfortunately not necessarily provide any balance on ethnicity. Or we might have some, say, sexual orientation in terms of, you know, equity or social justice, and we might have a quite open, diverse place. But then again, we might have problems with the racial abuse and everything. So that would be quite a unrealistic situation to have equity in terms of any kind of discourses that we think. But then unfortunately, that's not really going to happen. So it's not a utopic end that we're going through. It's just more like making incremental developments and changes so that we could really just improve bit by bit. But the more we improve, I guess, the better we understand what's next and how to improve. So this is more like an iterative process where you could really find an answer, and that leads you to even better questions and more answers and better questions.
Murat, what are the directions of your further research?
Well, I would like to follow this social justice perspective in the next project, and I would like to really understand how these perspectives are happening in actual discussions, because in the book I was really focusing on what's really happening in terms of students' experiences, and I would like to go a little bit deep into understanding how these discourses finding their way in the discussions itself. And that's one thing. And the other thing that I'm actually becoming much more interested in is to really understand the idea of scholarship and trying to really understand the doctoral education, particularly in terms of scholarship. And I'm trying to understand how the idea of scholarship can be decolonized. So I was trying to avoid that word, but I'm going to go for it. The reason that I want to avoid is that now, because it's becoming a little bit too popular, it's been used pretty much for everything, and any kind of a criticism is now named as like decolonization, which is not necessarily true. Anyway, I would like to really understand this idea of scholarship from the social justice perspectives, and I'm trying to really question that why we think of scholarship only in terms of Western perspective. So if you were to look the way that we provide PhDs, or the thing that we think people qualify for PhD necessarily represents the idea of enlightenment, going back to, you know, the enlightenment time in Europe, like in Middle Ages or the end of Middle Ages. So trying to really come up with the understanding of what is it that we could really do about it, and why we are just trying to hold on to this very old. It's good. I'm not criticizing the idea itself, but it's just only one perspective. And, you know, there could be other ways of trying to define scholarship. So it shouldn't be just necessarily because you read some books and you passed some courses, and then at the end you write like a 50,000 word that may or may not have any value in it, and then all of a sudden you become a doctor. So I think there should be a little bit more into it that we could really do. And there should be other perspectives out there that's available to us, and these are the perspectives perhaps could be providing some sort of injustices to other people, because if you're coming from a different background, all you're supposed to do is just write something and move on. But in certain places, this knowledge is created, knowledge is put into utilization through different formats, not necessarily in a written thesis that where you could define in front of two other people, two other scholars that, you know, which is called the viva, but the knowledge can be used in different ways. The knowledge can be really articulated in different ways. And so that should be possible to us right now. So I'm just trying to really understand this idea of scholarship. Those are two things that I'm currently interested in.
Thank you, Murat. Once again, thanks for agreeing to be a podcast guest and for such an interesting conversation.
Yeah, I thank you. Thank you so much. Sorry I interrupted you, but yeah, thank you so much again for the questions. I think they were really good. I'm really happy to be able to talk about the book.
I wish you all the best with your further research and hopefully we'll talk to you at some point in the future. It was Murat Ostok and the higher education researcher. Have a good day.